Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Hi, Armand.
Hello, Jimmy.
Now, I'm really excited today because we're going to be telling the story of Oedipus. People will have heard of Oedipus through the Oedipus complex, which we're also going to explain, right?
Yep.
But before we start, Oedipus, the word Oedipus, where does that come from?
Oedipus, okay. I mean, in Greek, Oedipus, it means a swollen foot. And, I mean, the word oid or eid bit is like the word edema, where you have a swelling.
Etymologies, you see. Etymologies.
Yeah, yeah. And pus, of course, means foot.
Where we get podos from.
Yeah, podiatrist and so on. And in Latin, pes, ped. So we have pedal, pedestrian, all those words. And they're all related. That is the supposed etymology of his name. And the idea is that this is someone who was exposed as a baby, his feet pinned together, as a result of which he had a swollen foot.
Yes, I mean, Oedipus, who was he and why are we still talking about him?
He's the hero of a play by Sophocles. Mm-hmm. So Sophocles, what do we know about him? He came from an elite family. He was himself a soldier. He won a number of prizes for the tragedies that he wrote. So these things were competitive. And Sophocles was one of the prize winners. He was a very respected man. He died very old. I think he was in his 90s. And he was known to be a religious man. So this is Sophocles in his late middle age writing the Oedipus. Mm-hmm. Oedipus Rex or Oedipus Tyrannus, Oedipus the King, as it means. And the story goes that King Laius of Thebes, a city to the north of Athens, had been told by the Delphic Oracle that his son would kill him and I think even would sleep with his wife. Jocasta.
The oracle, what? Just explain what an oracle is. Because it's a word that we use, don't we? But
yes, but for the ancient Greeks, it was a person who was inspired by a god, such as Apollo, would tell those people who inquired some truth that they might want to find out about and would then utter prophecies and predictions.
But sometimes these prophecies and predictions weren't that clear, were they? They were open.
Famously, they were ambiguous, especially yes. In the case of Apollo's oracle. And that makes sense, because if you imagine that from a rational point of view, these are human beings, how do they know they're going to get it right?
So very much like a modern politician.
Very much like that. You know, you say, this is what's going to happen. Then when it happens differently, you say, well, that's really what I meant.
Yes. Okay, got it.
So King Laius initially tries to avoid having a child, but then a baby is born, he orders it to be killed. Mm. So its ankles are pinned, and the idea is it's given to a servant to expose on the mountainside. This is how babies were killed. But the servant takes pity on the baby and hands it over to a shepherd. Mm. And that shepherd knows that there's a childless couple, King Polybus and Merope of Corinth, a different city, slightly different part of the Greek world, and takes it to Corinth and gives it to Polybus and Merope to bring up as their own child. Right. So Oedipus survives.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's given the name Oedipus because he has swollen feet, presumably from having had them pinned. Mm. So when he's growing up, he thinks he's the child of the king of King Polybus of Corinth. Mm. But someone at a banquet claims that he's not. Mm. Oedipus is furious about this, goes to the Delphic Oracle, and there he learns that his fate is to kill his father and sleep with his mother. And he thinks this means Polybus and Merope back in Corinth. So he decides never to go there.
So he leaves Corinth.
Goes into exile.
Near a city?
He does end up going to Thebes, which is at that moment being ravaged by this awful Sphinx.
Ah.
I mean, a Sphinx, what is a Sphinx?
Right.
It's this monster with the head of a woman, the body of a lion, the wings of a bird, supposedly. We all know about the Sphinx of Giza. You have that image in your mind.
Yes, because that's what I thought. It's like, was there more than one Sphinx then?
Oh, there are hundreds of sphinxes,
really?
Or okay. Sphinges. This is very much the Greek version. I mean, so in Egyptian culture, the sphinxes would have been statues that mm-hmm. would have been placed in front of buildings today.
To protect the space. Yeah.
Yeah, sort of protective creatures. But for the Greeks, it turned into a myth of a very threatening monster.
It would pose the question, the famous...
So the Sphinx poses the question, what goes on 4 feet in the morning, 2 feet in the afternoon, and 3 feet in the evening? That is the riddle of the Sphinx. And the idea is if you don't answer it, then you get devoured.
God, it's like a precursor of Squid Game, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, there are...
I mean, the penalty for not getting the right answer.
Because the answer to what goes on four legs at morning... Two legs during the day and three in the evening is?
A man.
Why?
Because in the morning of his life, he crawls around like a little baby. Sometimes as a teenager, when he had too much to drink, of course. And at noon, he can be a biped. He can prance around on 2 feet. I'm using he now in the multi-gender use of that word, just to be on the safe side. And in the evening of his life, where I'm heading, he has to have a stick. As W.B. Yeats said, an old man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick. And he has that kind of image of the old man shambling along with the stick. And right. Oedipus was the guy who solved the problem.
So Oedipus, being a clever man, and this is very important for the purpose of play, answers the riddle and becomes king of Thebes. He enters Thebes in triumph.
And then what happened to the Sphinx when she was...
What we learn is that the Sphinx throws herself off the rock and dies as a result of someone answering the question correctly.
Wow. I mean, that's...
So having ravaged the territory of Thebes for years,
right.
The Thebans are delighted when Oedipus comes along, solves the riddle, and the Sphinx kills herself.
Mm.
On the way to Thebes, there's a road rage incident.
Yes.
This old man in a chariot with his... retainers tells Oedipus to get out of the way at the crossroads. Oedipus is so furious, he kills this old man, who apparently sort of shakes his stick at him.
Chariot rage.
Yeah, chariot rage. He kills him, and he kills all the servants apart from one.
Okay.
And he then goes on, and this is the background of the story, and it's as if, oh, well, you know, I just killed someone on the road. But anyway, here I am, I've just answered the riddle of the Sphinx, I've become king of Thebes. And I married the former king's wife.
He doesn't tell anybody that he's had this incident on the road. As far as he's concerned, he's killed the Sphinx and now he's a big hero.
He's a big hero.
What's the prize for killing the Sphinx?
The prize is to become the king of Thebes and to marry the queen.
And he was recently widowed, of course, because their husband was killed...
By some stranger.
So Oedipus is the current king of Thebes.
Oedipus, as a king of Thebes... is presented by his people begging to be saved from a terrible plague which has descended on their city.
Mm.
He asks, what is the issue? Why is there this plague? Normally in ancient Greek culture, if there's a plague, it's because there is a criminal in the midst. And he has sent his brother-in-law, Creon, off to Delphi, where there's the oracle, to ask what the problem is. And Creon comes back and he says, there is indeed a criminal in our midst. It is someone who has killed the king of Thebes, Oedipus as king succeeded, but didn't know apparently who his predecessor was, and that was Laius, king of Thebes. He has been killed. The murderer is in our midst. He has to be discovered.
Right.
So that's the beginning of the mystery.
Actually, this is turning into one of those kind of true crime podcast, isn't it? You know, so we know that Oedipus is the king. The old king has been killed by somebody now living in Thebes, And what does Oedipus decide to do at this point once he gets this information from his brother-in-law?
First of all, he lays a curse on whoever has done this. Terrible curse that this person should be exiled or worse. Mm. So
when he stands up and says, I curse the person who's done this, the audience are going, oh no.
And he decides he's going to get to the bottom of this. And one of the ways in which he does that is by summoning the prophet Tiresias, blind prophet, who often gets things right, or seems always to get things right, but somehow Oedipus, being a rather hot-headed and tyrannical-natured individual, doesn't listen to him in this case, because Tiresias comes and says, you don't want to know the answer to this.
And Oedipus says, well, how would you know? You're blind. And then there's a wonderful line with lots of T's in it. Tuflasta tota toton.
Tuflasta tota.
Yeah. It's you're blind in your mind and in your thoughts and
in your ears, yes.
And isn't that what the Greeks would recognise in Oedipus as his fatal flaw?
Yes, so you bring in this term, fatal flaw, the term presented to us by Aristotle, hamartia. Mm. There's a lot of discussion about what that means, but in a tragic play, the idea is that you've got somebody who isn't necessarily a bad person. Mm. Aristotle said, actually, you don't want a bad person who just gets things wrong and then eventually is destroyed. That person has to be a good person, but right, has to suffer from a fatal flaw, which brings him down. Now, what is Oedipus's flaw? One explanation of the flaw in this case is that it's his character. Mm. He is imperious. Mm. He doesn't listen. He believes he knows. And knowledge and blindness are very much the themes that we see in the play.
What they call hubris.
Very much. Hubris, the idea that he is excessive, has thoughts beyond mortal levels. So when Oedipus stands up and says, I'm going to try and find who the murderer of Laius is, we know that it's him. Mm. And very quickly, he is told that it's him because he calls in the prophet Tiresias, who says, you know, I wouldn't go any further if I were you. And he says, what are you talking about, old man? And he says, well, it's you. Mm. And he says, oh, don't talk rubbish. You've been bribed. And he accuses Tiresias and Creon, his brother-in-law, Jocasta's brother, of trying to overthrow his kingship and take it in their place. And they're doing it all for profit. So he's very money-minded.
So that's quite modern, isn't it?
Very modern.
That way of deflecting from your responsibility. That's very much the Trump kind of whataboutism, isn't it? Well, what about them? It's not me, it's you.
That's exactly what he does, yes. Mm. He tries to deflect it. Now, one might say that he must at some level have remembered.
I mean, as a professor of hindsight, I can say that, you know, when you're told you're going to kill your father and marry your mother, and you kill a man old enough to be your father, and then pop into town and marry someone old enough to be your mother, you might think, he's obviously very intelligent because of those things. But also, this is about intelligence, different kinds of intelligence, aren't there? There's kind of academic, in that kind of grappling with a problem and solving it. Mm. But actually, on the emotional, the kind of savvy, the emotional intelligence level, he's obviously quite short in supply, isn't he?
Yes, and the way Sophocles sets up the story, and I think this has got to be pretty clear, is that he doesn't know what he's done. He is doing everything he possibly can to push aside any knowledge that he might be the culprit himself. So something about psychological defences immediately emerges. You've done something bad, you don't want to know about it. The way it's presented is he has no inkling of what he himself
has done. What they call denial these days.
He's in deep, deep denial, yeah. Because there is a scholarly interpretation which says he does know at some level.
Right.
You could perhaps go through the text of Sophocles' play and find ways in which Sophocles is indicating that at some level Oedipus is aware that he has been responsible for this death that he is investigating. And indeed, the term used in Greek, which the chorus say to Oedipus, you're a man of knowledge, you somehow know, in Greek, oistha pou, and if you turn it into I somehow know in Greek, oida pou, it sounds a bit like Oedipus.
So it's a pun.
It's a pun. Yeah. So what he's done is he's escaped from Corinth, determined never to go there again. And he's come to Thebes, he's now king of Thebes, and he thinks he's far away from danger. He thinks, Mum and Dad are back there. I haven't gone anywhere near them, so I can't kill my father, I can't sleep with my mother. And in the course of the play, Sophocles very brilliantly works it so that just as we're beginning to think, surely at this point Oedipus knows that it's him, Tiresias has told him it's him, effectively, and Tiresias doesn't get these things wrong. He's come from the Delphic Oracle, you know, and then at that moment, a messenger comes from Corinth to say that King Polybus is dead. Mm. This is the person who Oedipus thinks is his real father. Now, instead of saying, oh, well, you know, what's that got to do with me? He says, oh, well, it proves that the Delphic Oracle is rubbish. I can't kill my father because he's died.
And is that his first response? It's not, oh, God, my father's dead.
Well, he has an exchange with Jocasta. Mm. And Jocasta, his, you know, who is in fact his mother, but is now his wife, realises that this is a let-out clause. So, yes, they go to the rational place. Your father's dead. All that Delphic stuff is nonsense. Don't worry about it. So that being the case, we think, is he off the hook? But at that stage, what we have is the revelation that as a baby, he was given not...
not the biological... offspring of...
At which point Jocasta realises, when she hears this, she realises what must have happened and that this is her own child who had been sent off to Corinth.
Well, with whom she has children, of course, now.
Yeah, they do have children.
They've been together for years. Now, at this point when the play happens, they've been together for a while.
Yes, so they have the twins Polynices and Eteocles. They have two daughters, Antigone and Ismene, and they will be the subjects of later Greek tragedies.
Because there were three plays, weren't there?
There are several plays that deal with the so-called Theban cycle. So the Antigone...
Most famous, the Antigone, I mean, Sophocles, the playwright, and of course then Freud, thousands of years later, or a couple of thousand years later, they both recognise that the inherent drama of being in a family is quite extraordinary. Just any family has its own internal dynamics that... Any family gathering, if you think about all the great plays that have been written about family gatherings, at birthdays or at Thanksgiving in American literature, where they come together and these old wounds are revisited. You know, these are great kind of ancient tragedies, but they're families. They're just
and pretty well
stories.
All ancient tragedies are exactly about that, about the family dynamics that lead to all sorts of awful things happening. Daughters killing themselves, like in the case of Antigone. Yeah,
I mean, could you have EastEnders without Sophocles? I'm not sure. The audience now, the three people who listen to this podcast are now desperate to find out what happens at the end of the play, because the pennies drop for Jocasta. Oh my God, I have been married to my own son, which is a pretty awful moment for her.
Yeah, and she kills herself.
Right.
So she realises what the truth is. She kills herself. And you would have thought that should be enough for Oedipus to understand what's going on, but he needs to make sure. So he says, call that shepherd. That is the man who took Oedipus as a child and took it to his adoptive parents in Corinth.
Who were the king and queen of
Corinth? King and queen of Corinth. Mm. And let's try and see what happened. And of course, when the shepherd comes and explains, Oedipus immediately realises that this is him who has been exposed as a child, grown up in Corinth, but is in fact the child of the man he killed on the crossroads and the woman he has married and has children with. So he blinds himself.
I think he uses a pin from Jocasta's clothing.
He takes the pin from Jocasta and blinds himself with it.
What's that moment? Because if you just take a moment to think about when you're sitting there watching this play in Athens, how horrified would they have been?
They would have been horrified at the notion of incest and at the notion of parricide. So these are, in some ways, two of the worst things that you could possibly do as a human being. Yeah. And the problem is that, in many ways, Oedipus is innocent. He does, as you say, he does it unwittingly. He's noble. He's a saviour of Thebes. So he has all these very important traits of character that are then contradicted by his conduct. Mm. And we also then discover that that conduct is not entirely foreign to his nature.
Yeah, it's his gift and his curse, isn't it?
It's both, yes.
Also, he is who he is, so how could he not found out? Because that's the flaw.
So he's a clever man. Mm. So part of the flaw is he thinks he's terribly clever. Mm. He's a man, after all, who's solved the riddle of the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. But he's this hot-headed individual as well who has killed a man on the crossroads and promptly denied any memory of it, apparently. So Oedipus realizes, I am the murderer myself. That immediately leads to a reversal. The Greek word is peripeteia. So the recognition then leads to a reversal. One minute he's the king, he's respected, he's loved. Next minute he is lost everything and he's blinded and he's sent into exile. So the denouement.
And we see that, don't we, in modern life, where a respected figure, something is revealed about them, especially these days, you know, the kind of wildfire of social media.
Yes.
And then within a moment,
everything is
there's an expression
around.
That you can spend 25 years building a reputation and 1 second to lose it. It's as quick as that, isn't it?
That is the essence of tragedy, especially if, you know, these are good people, essentially.
There must be an element of, I'm sitting there watching this man suddenly realise what's happened to him, thinking, I'm glad that's not me.
Well, that's one of the explanations of catharsis.
Right.
It's another term that was used by Aristotle, which means a purgation, a getting rid of feelings, specifically negative feelings of, he identified as pity and fear. Mm. And he said that this was the proper pleasure of tragedy. So why do you want to go along and watch a tragic play in which people kill themselves, blind themselves, discover they slept with their mother, killed their father? Why on earth? What sort of entertainment is that?
Yeah.
Aristotle's answer was that the proper pleasure, as he put it, of tragedy is that it gives you a catharsis, the ability to get rid of feelings of pity and fear that build up inside you. So, you know, why do you walk out of the theatre feeling pleased that you've watched the tragedy?
Yeah.
Because it's not us.
Yeah.
We're not on the stage. And Aristotle did think that was the important thing about tragedy, that it was educational, that you watch this in a space that was safe, in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, you can read about it, you can feel those emotions, but you're not, it's not happening to you, in fact. You're not murdering your
father. Which is a very human reaction.
Yeah.
Is when you see someone going through something awful, you may want to say, God, I feel for you and I empathise with you. But there is that part of you. I mean, my grandfather told this story. I mean, he's long dead now, but in the First World War, he's in the trenches. And he told my father this. He said, you'd hear a shot ring out, you look to your right, and someone you knew quite well had just had his head blown off. Your first thought is, I'm glad it's not me.
Right.
And then you go into the shock and horror. So there's that feeling of, as human beings, you know, we see other human beings going through tragedy, but there we are. It's not us. Thank God it's not us.
Yes, and there's that, but there's also, as you say, the empathy.
Mm.
And empathy allows us to grow psychologically. Mm. And this is something that Aristotle in his Politics talks about, the importance of art as a way of allowing us to grow up.
And it leaves us with a feeling that we've seen someone go through something awful, which we can learn from.
Exactly.
And that's what drove Sophocles to write the play, do you think?
Well, we don't know. So Sophocles doesn't tell us why he thinks he needed to write the play of Oedipus. Aristotle gives us his interpretation. It's about 100 years later.
Mm.
So it's just an interpretation. Mm. Unfortunately, we don't have any contemporary writing about why the tragedians did it, apart from that they were entering a tragic competition.
Mm.
So they were doing it in order to win a prize in the Dionysiac Festival.
And where were these plays put on? Because, I mean, we go to the West End now, but where would the Greeks see these plays?
So these were all put on in the theatre of Dionysus in Athens, which is on the southern slope of the Acropolis. But at the time, it wasn't the sort of developed theatre, this wonderful stone semicircle that we think about as Greek theatre. As far as we know, and it's hard to tell because excavations have to give us their story and we have to work out dating and so on, but that stone theatre that we imagine as the theatre of Dionysus probably didn't emerge until the end of the 5th century. So in the course of the 5th century, perhaps there were just benches in that area. Some scholars now reckon that it was in a sort of trapezoid shape. There were three sides to this, and there was a stage in the middle. So we have to perhaps imagine 5,000 or 6,000 people attending this theatre in the time of Sophocles.
And what was the occasion of it? I mean, what were the
at the Dionysiac Festival? So Dionysus, the god of theatre, a festival several days long,
right,
at which competitive tragedies and comedies are performed.
So it was a religious competition.
A religious competition, yes.
Right.
So to do with Dionysus, though the plays themselves don't have to do with that god. In fact, there was a saying in ancient Greek, nothing to do with Dionysus, which had something to do with the fact that perhaps Dionysus, although it was his festival, was hosting all these plays which had nothing to do with Dionysus.
And so just talk us through what the average evening was like then. So you go to the theatre.
Not the evening, though.
What was it?
No, because they didn't have artificial lighting. So we imagine that theatre takes place in the evening.
They
had to put on their plays during the day.
Wow. And how many plays would they see a day?
There were 5 days, and there would have been a competition between comedians, tragedians, and there was also another event called the Dithyram, which was a large dance with 50 men and 50 boys in a large circle. In fact, that was the main Dionysiac element. Mm. So it was a big song, and we have some of those dithyrams that survived by Pindar.
So would you see a tragedy followed by another tragedy, or would they mix it up?
So it was tragedies, the trilogy. Mm-hmm. So tragedies were written in three. Mm-hmm. Then there was something called a satyr play, which was what we call a comedy,
yeah,
a comic scenario which you laugh at. Mm. Comedies were a bit more like reviews. You know, you can talk to the audience and make jokes about them.
Mm. So we should definitely do this in a podcast. We should definitely do Aristophanes.
Definitely, yes. I mean, he's a wonderful comedian. But, you know, he makes jokes and talks to his audience.
Yeah.
So,
and about contemporary politicians.
And it's all about contemporaries and so on. It's a bit like, you know, Rory Bremner or something.
And we'll get onto this now, but what we've taken from the play, I mean, is what Freud looked at the play and came up with is Oedipus complex, didn't he?
So Freud said, having read the play, he'd read it as a child in Greek, but when he was coming up with his psychological theories, he said, Oedipus's fate appeals to us. Because, in a way, we've all been through this.
Mm.
We've all been through a stage at which we want to kill our father and we want to sleep with our mother.
Yeah. All right, Sigmund.
So that was...
Really?
Well, he did say perhaps. Let's give it to him.
A stand-up comedian might say, is it just me or do we all want to sleep with our mothers and kill our fathers? And a stand-up comedian will know very quickly, but there's a response from the audience. Because Oedipus himself, the man who gave us the title of it, he didn't have an Oedipus complex, did he?
No. So Oedipus has no Oedipus complex. He is not someone who is interested in sleeping with his mother and killing his father. The whole point is that these things are done without him knowing. And that was something that Freud was picking up on. I mean, it's not that we actually want to sleep with our mothers or kill our fathers. Let's face it, you know, you start off feeling that you're one with your mother because there you are on the breast. And this is somewhat male-oriented, I should say.
I wasn't breastfed, so, you know.
Well, there we are. But you know, somehow in the structure of our minds, we start as a dyad, as a linked couple with our mother. And then this third object comes into view, this father who seems to have even better claim on the provider of milk or of life or of warmth or of love. And we want to get rid of that thing. We want to push it out. So if you take it to extremes, we are in love with our mother, we hate our father, but then you realize you can't sustain those feelings. You can't sustain a feeling of hatred for your father. And that is why this very, very early instinct that Freud recognized or thought he recognized in human beings is something that we feel and instantly suppress.
But it's also interesting that you know, the Oedipus complex is not a cliche, but it's a much used expression and bandied around a lot. And yet we don't know where it comes from. And that's why I think this kind of podcast is helpful, is that you then delve into it and think, that's where it comes from. Yes. And we talk about etymology. So I was thinking about the word etymology this week, actually, and I thought, I wonder where etymology comes from.
Yes.
And it's etymos, true.
Truthful,
Truthful, and logos is the study of?
The study of truth.
There you go. So that's the etymology of etymology.
It is, and of course, there are lots of false etymologies, which is an oxymoron because it is both false and true to say that something, so, you know, the idea, for example, of the word outrage comes from out and rage. It doesn't come from that at all. It comes from outrage, outre in French, you know, otherness. So something like that is a false etymology, but it seems to work rather well.
Oxymoron. What's the etymology of oxymoron?
So oxy means sharp. Mm. Think of oxyacetylene.
Yes.
Moron, of course, means stupid. We know the word
know
moron.
Yeah.
Yes. And so this is both sharp in the...
It's a great word, oxymoron. Sense, yeah,
and stupid.
It's like, there are many versions of it, like military intelligence.
Yes. A Frenchman once told me that his favourite oxymoron was English cuisine. Well, I think that's very unfair.
Or French humility.
Can I tell my poem about the Sphinx?
Yeah.
The sexual life of the camel...
Oh, yes.
..is stranger than anyone thinks. In moments of unbridled passion, it tries to make love to the Sphinx. But the Sphinx's posterior channel is blocked by the sands of the Nile, which accounts for the hump on the camel and the Sphinx's inscrutable smile.
It's All Greek and Latin to Me is presented by Armand Dangour and Jimmy Melville. The producer is Diggory Waite, and the executive producer is Claire Broughton. It's All Greek and Latin to Me is a Hattrick podcast.
Hi, everyone. I just wanted to give a mention to Classics for All. Classics for All is a charity, and what we want to do is provide access to the classics to as many state school pupils as possible, alongside training teachers who don't actually have to have any previous training in the subject. They hope that they make classics a sustainable part of the school curriculum. If you want to find out more about this fantastic charity, go to the website. It's www.classicsforall.org.uk.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.